Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Psyched to have you all listening. As always, I'm your host, Neil Horwitz. You can find more information on the podcast and see previous episodes at dsmsports.net, and follow me on Twitter at njh287. Really good show coming up for you all today. We have a great guest, someone who's a bit of a celebrity in the field, even though he won't tell you that. And that is Sports Illustrated columnist and writer, and also a well-known commentator of sports media on Twitter, and that is Richard Deitch. Real good conversation coming up with Richard. But before we get into that interview, we have this episode's helpful tool. And this episode's helpful tool is called Giphy, or Giphy, however you want to pronounce it. And it is the Google for GIFs, pretty much, with GIFs just penetrating everywhere since Twitter started supporting them, especially the animated GIFs, especially. It's everyone is trying to learn how to find or create their own cool or funny GIFs. And Giphy, I'm going to go with Giphy for now, is a great place to find a quick GIF, no matter what you're looking for, a quick reactionary GIF, something funny, something to go along with a news story or a blog post. And you can find the most popular recent GIFs. You can search by keyword. You can just browse by category. It really is the most robust search engine for GIFs out there. And it, then once you find the GIF you want, you can easily share across social platforms or download the file itself or embed the file itself if you want to use it in a blog post or in a tweet, for example. You can just have the file itself and then upload it as a pic.twitter GIF. Everyone's trying to get creative with GIFs. It still remains to be seen whether they are superior to tweets with images or not, as far as the engagement and the interest level for users and fans following along. But either way, GIFs are here to stay, and you might as well try to start experimenting with them, seeing how your fans respond. Every audience is different, and maybe you might find a great collection of GIFs out there that really makes your content pop. It's a great place to start before you start trying to teach yourself how to create really cool GIFs. See how GIFs work for your content. And a good place to start is Giphy. That's Giphy.com. All free, easy to download GIFs, searchable, browsable, top 100, what's hot by category. You're going to find a great resource in Giphy.com. So that's this episode's helpful tool. It'll have you looking like a master GIF creator in no time, and get to it. So check out Giphy.com. All right, we'll be right back with our great interview. Stick around for this. You're going to want to hear it. We have Richard Deitch coming right up. All right, that was this episode's helpful tool. It's called Giphy. With the increasing preponderance of GIFs all over Twitter now, it's a good resource to have to find a quick GIF, because, you know, after a goal is scored in a big World Cup game, you want to find that nice GIF of a dancing John McCain or something like that. I don't know. Let's get our guest take on GIFs. We are meeting with Sports Illustrated writer, columnist Richard Deitch. Richard, what's your take on Twitter GIFs so far?
Geez, that's the first question, Neil. Twitter GIFs. It's such a 2.0 question. First and foremost, I admire the people who do them and do them fast. Some of them are fun, some of them are ridiculous, but more than anything else, I admire the skill, the production skill of a lot of places that turns around GIFs in a matter of seconds, you know, especially from a live sporting event. So there's a lot of people out there. There's just a lot of, and most of them are generally speaking 20-something people with really great production skills who just can turn the stuff around on a dime. So that's generally what I'm most impressed by, as opposed to the content, which obviously sometimes is great and other times it gets a little too much.
It definitely does blow your mind a little bit when you see a GIF of a goal or a big play in a sporting game almost ready on Twitter before the replay is even shown on TV. It's insane.
Yeah, and there's certain sports where I think it really plays well, and obviously, like, we're talking during the World Cup, so goals are few and far between, generally speaking, in soccer compared to, baskets in basketball, et cetera. So a GIF in that sport really has value because it may, you know, it sort of holds up. We may not get another goal for 30, 40 minutes, and it's cool to watch, you know, Van Persie's header or a strike from Ronaldo or something like that, you know, within 5 minutes of the goal itself. So we've seen some cool ones, at least during the World Cup.
Yeah, definitely. It'll be interesting to see where that space goes. But I don't want to spend too much time on gifts because we are delighted to have you here today. First off, let me formally welcome you, Richard Deitch, Sports Illustrated writer and columnist. I've been a long-time admirer of you, and thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Yeah, no problem at all, man.
All right, so before we get into the real meat of the discussion, we always like to get to know our guest. You're living the dream, so to speak, and you're writing for Sports Illustrated.
I'm living the dream. Is that correct? As we like to say at Sports Illustrated, do you have that confirmed, or is that just speculation at this point?
I'll say it. Sources are reporting.
Sources. It's very ESPN of you. You say media reports, but all right, go on.
So, Richard, tell us a little about how you got to where you are today, and any tips you may have along the way.
Well, there's seriously nothing worse than any human being giving their resume in any form. I'll try to do this fast. And my career arc is much different than most people, and will be different than anybody your age. I went to school in Buffalo, undergrad at the University of Buffalo, worked a couple years covering the Bills and Sabres right after that, on top of the fact that, you know, I was in my, worked for my college newspaper, started as a freshman. Buffalo is a great city to be in because as a college student, you were able to cover the Bills and the Sabres and pro teams because it just wasn't a big market. After a couple years of covering the Bills and Sabres, I went to grad school in New York at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Got an internship at SI for Kids immediately out of grad school. They hired me, and then Sports Illustrated hired me 6 months later. So I've basically been at this job for, I mean, a long time, you know, 15, 16 years or so, and have worked for every part of the brand, from swimsuit to our commemorative division to we used to have a magazine here, SI for Women. Obviously, people know that who are familiar with my work know I do a lot of stuff online for SI.com. So my career path is untraditional because I don't have a lot of employers other than Sports Illustrated and a couple of employers in Buffalo. And then away from SI, I'm an adjunct professor at Columbia. I work with a very famous professor named Sandy Padway, teaching sports journalism. And on top of that, live in Manhattan with my wife, and always root for Buffalo teams to do well. That's pretty much the resume in full.
Oh, fantastic. And my sympathies for being a Buffalo fan.
Yeah, I don't know. A fan may be for me at this point. You know, you sort of work in this business long enough. You're not really a fan, or at least, I mean, I know some sports writers and writers are, and that's cool. I more sort of look at it as I sort of wish for this. At least when I look at Buffalo, I'm wishing for the city to do well in sports because I really like the people of the city more than, like, on a week-to-week basis, I'm, like, rooting for the Bills or Sabres to win. It's a city that hasn't had a winner in so long, probably much like Cleveland, that I think it just would be so appreciated for a championship team to come to Buffalo.
Oh, that's an excellent point. So it sounds like you were under the Sports Illustrated brand coming right out of school, or right out of grad school at least, and really bounced around a lot of different departments there as far as what you were writing about in particular, whether it was kids or swimsuit or women's sports, I know. Was it really a passion and a love for writing that propelled you throughout your years there, or was it writing about sports, no matter what that sport may be? Was it just a passion for any sport?
Yeah, ever since I was young, I really loved to read, first and foremost. I would read, anything I could get my hands on. We had three newspapers delivered to our home ever since I can remember, and I loved just reading, especially the sports section growing up. And so writing just became something I loved to do. I wrote for my first newspaper when I was 16, which was a local newspaper. So for me, at least as I've sort of moved up in my career, you know, I just love to write. I mean, I have an affinity for sports and I have a knowledge of sports, so it sort of works that way. But, you know, a lot of what I do now, I'm not writing about games every day. I'm writing more about media every day. So it's more like, for SI, I've always tried to find different things to do, you know, whether it's going out and covering the U.S. Open or whether it's covering media. I don't think I'm built to just cover one sport. I don't think I would be a very good beat person. It just sort of doesn't fit me. So I kind of admire the people who are really great on one beat and who sort of make that their own, because that's not something I could do. So at least at SI, I've just tried to do as many different things as I could. You know, I also edited SI, so I'm not just only doing writing on a daily basis. So that, for me, it's I've tried to do different things because that just, I find that interesting. And Sports Illustrated has been a really good place for me just because there's so many, there's been so many different sort of brands within the brand that you get opportunities to do different things.
Definitely. And I think it's no secret that Sports Illustrated certainly does transcend the beat, and they go beyond, they go the stories beyond the stories, the stuff that's more timeless and can go week to week rather than, you know, day to day. But I did want to sort of get into a little bit about, it's a good segue into what your role really encompasses today. I think most people know you as someone that writes about the sports media, keeps up with a lot of things in that realm. Other people may know you from your columns and your women's sports coverage, especially in the recent years. What is your role really right now, and how did you sort of become this quote unquote sports media guru, or however you want to put it?
What, quote unquote? Why the quote unquote, Daniel? And guru is just a weird word. That sounds like somebody who should be like selling, liniment and snake oil somewhere. In terms of what I'm doing, I just sort of fell into media about 8 or 9 years ago. I was doing a lot of work in the magazine. We had basically a media column there every week, and it was me and a couple other people who were rotating. And I just sort of, I think out of happenstance, one person left. So I started doing far more media in the magazine. And then when I moved to the web like 7 years ago or so, I pitched them on, can I do like a, essentially like a weekly column? They let me do it, and it just sort of has grown since then. And then, as our site's gotten bigger, there's just been more of an appetite for media writing, which just covers.
Is the appetite there coming from the fans, or is it coming from the media and the other commentators?
But I'd say both. I'd say both, because you got to keep in mind. Just think about this. You know, take your average ESPN commentator, let's say Jeff Van Gundy or something, or Mike Breen. Mm-hmm. You know, you can make the argument that those two guys are more famous than the sixth man of almost every team. Or if you, the better analogy is like baseball. You know, more people can identify Chris Berman in this country than they could the second starter of most Major League Baseball teams. So it's these people who deliver your sports to your home are, you know, they're in your home 24/7. So they're people very recognizable. And, you know, if nothing else, I've tried to cover sports media as a beat in the same way you would cover the Mets or the Yankees or the Cubs, et cetera. So I think, yeah, I mean, I think I think one of the things that helped the space, the sports media space, sites like Deadspin, et cetera, have written a lot about the media, and I think you've seen a lot of 20-somethings really interested in this kind of content, where, maybe 15, 20 years ago, the only sort of media columns that existed were in local newspapers. You know, the Daily News would have a column, or USA Today would have its Rudy Martsky column, but I think Deadspin sort of, in particular, changed the game a little bit by writing, and a lot of times sort of writing not positively, about broadcasters. And now we see Awful Announcing, The Big Lead. There's a million sort of blogs out there that have sports media elements to it. So I think I'm just, I'm sort of just part of that wave.
Well, especially now you have so many outlets for content that sports media is an emerging one and growing one. It's another place where someone like yourself or an Awful Announcing or any of these number of bloggers can really find a niche that definitely has some interest. And I think social media and the day-to-day, everything blowing up minute to minute, might help fuel that interest to some degree.
Well, there's no doubt that for me, Twitter has been really a big game changer. I mean, I think a lot of people only know me exclusively from Twitter, and that has given me a forum to push my stuff. So that's been incredibly huge for me, the opportunity to have my own distribution channel to forward my links to. You know, my Twitter feed is not just a self-promotional tool. The real sort of basis for that feed is to send out interesting stories and interesting links to people, and hopefully people consider me a good gatekeeper or good curator, because that's what I want ultimately my Twitter feed to be. And then basically the other 10-15% of the feed is my stuff, and hopefully people will read it. So Twitter has really helped in that sense, and social media has really helped in that sense. When it comes to more niche things, like stuff that I do, sports media, women's basketball, et cetera, the great thing about Twitter or Facebook is you can find the people who are doing the kind of stuff that you like and basically have it delivered into your inbox.
With this new focus, or this, I guess, reinvigorated, renewed focus on some of the stuff that's going on in sports media, whether it is breaking down who the commentators will be for a major sporting event, or you know, how someone decided to ask a question after a major sporting event. How much is social media really starting to, or even what you guys are, what you're doing with your media column, starting to fuel the way sports media is both put together and portrayed and executed? Is it affecting ESPN's decisions day to day, and what people are saying on Twitter, or what people like yourself are saying as well?
Yeah, I mean, listen, absolutely it is. I mean, the fact is that you are seeing, I mean, look at the new SportsCenter set, which just debuted last week. They're using, one of their elements is Twitter, basically, and generally speaking, it's what famous people are saying about X. So, you know, every single producer, whether it's ESPN or whether it's a local producer, is watching Twitter and seeing what trending topics exist so they can capitalize on that via search, via SEO, et cetera. I mean, social media has impacted every single sports outlet, whether it's a gigantic one like ESPN or whether it's a local website. So both the short and long answer to that is absolutely. And ESPN absolutely wants to not only impact what people are talking about on social media, but they absolutely react to it as well.
A couple of, I guess, big picture questions coming out of that. One is it a good thing that the people seem to be really leading the way, and that what's hitting well on social media is ultimately fueling what's going to be on SportsCenter's rundown for that night, or what's going to be in their A block? And B, are we okay with having the social media audience, or even that Twitter audience, which at the end of the day is only, you know, maybe 100 million Americans from a day-to-day basis, is that serving the whole sports media audience enough?
Well, there's no doubt that I think the impact of Twitter is not as great, nearly as great as journalists think it is. I mean, ultimately, it's very heavy usage is from the media in general, so I think they overweigh it. But you can't argue with Facebook's numbers. I mean, you know, even during the World Cup, whatever the crazy number is, 500 million impressions, for, you know, World Cup related stuff. So it has an impact on all this stuff. You know, where people, I think, are still trying to figure out is how can I make money on social media if I'm an ESPN or Fox Sports 1, et cetera. But I think if you are in the business of sports media, you have to be on social media, or you are really not doing you or your readers justice, in my opinion, because you are not following where the conversation is.
Very much so. Who is leading the conversation in your mind? Is it the ESPN and SportsCenter folks who really are sort of throwing fuel on the fire and helping lead turn a Tim Tebow into a story that never ends, or a Johnny Manziel into a really overblown story? Or is it just ESPN saying, okay, well, you know, we put a headline out, or we put the story about this guy doing really well and getting a lot of chatter, so let's keep on fanning the flames and not go to maybe a more richer, rewarding story?
Well, there's no doubt that ESPN leads the sports conversation in this country just by tonnage, by multiple platforms, by just the sort of the power that they have. Doesn't mean they're the only ones, but they are absolutely number one. So if they want to make something a topic in this country on a day-to-day basis, they can do it. I mean, you've seen that with the World Cup. They've really put a ton of resources towards it, and it's resulted in great ratings and great streaming viewership and conversation. So they lead it. I think locally still, sports talk radio, your newspaper, if it's a powerful newspaper in that town, still has a massive role in leading the sports conversation. I'll take Buffalo, for instance. Buffalo News is a single newspaper entity in that town. Generally speaking, that leads the conversation on a day-to-day basis. Radio usually follows what that newspaper does, and so the Buffalo News is a big leader locally. But you know, if a major topic happens on ESPN, people in Buffalo will be talking about that as well. So, you know, the great thing is that everybody can sort of dictate things nationally if it's the right story. You know, somebody has a story about Aaron Rodgers does something that has national impact, and the Green Bay Press Gazette is the one that breaks that. They can dictate a story for the day. But generally speaking, with its tonnage and multiple platform power, it's ESPN who leads the conversation.
Definitely. How about from your own personal perspective, seeing this evolution over the years, when you're looking at content or when your bosses or your colleagues are looking at content for Sports Illustrated, for example, whether it's the magazine or the website, have they now put a lot more weight into let's check what what's been trending on Twitter and Google and Facebook the last few days versus here's what we think are the most compelling stories in sports based on what we've seen in, you know, newspapers or however it used to be done in the old days of the 90s.
Not necessarily on the magazine side. The magazine side still, I think, is dictated by what's the sort of the richest and best storytelling, and can we try to sort of tell stories that no one's telling? There's no doubt in the front of the magazine. I think that's been dictated by a lot of the sort of ESPNization. Our front of our magazine is shorter pieces, et cetera. But in general, I don't think so. I think if you pick up Sports Illustrated the magazine, there's still long-form stuff and stories in there that you're generally not going to find elsewhere. There's no doubt, though, that our website absolutely has to pay attention to what's going on Google search and what's going on Twitter and Facebook. I think every sports website, especially every sports news website in the country, would do that. You have to, because you have to ultimately, if something is sort of a Google hot search, that means people are interested. So then you have to, as a site, dictate, okay, you know, what do we do with this information? Is there a story in there that we can do that's sort of editorially sound and smart that can capitalize on this? You know, what you don't want to do is you don't want to always sort of be geared by search or by SEO. That is, generally speaking, a successful business, and, you know, we've seen Bleacher Report and other places do that. We don't do that all the time, but we absolutely do use it as a tool, and we have to use it as a tool, I think, to sort of be a successful business. So, trending and all that stuff absolutely impacts what we do on a day-to-day basis in terms of the website. I would say far less when it comes to the magazine.
So, is that having an overall net positive or net negative or any sort of, you know, really tangible effect on the I don't want to say value, but quality of the sports information, sports news that's being produced out there now versus several more years ago when it wasn't as so dependent on clicks or what a 12-year-old is searching for on Google day to day?
Well, I would say it's both. I would say there's more great stuff in sports media than we've ever had before, because there's so many new players into the market and there's so many interesting stories, you know, whether it's a Vice or an SB Nation, what SI does. At the same time, because of speed and because of sort of trying to chase clicks, there's more absolute shite on a day-to-day basis than we've ever seen before. So I think I would say it's up to you to be a smart reader and viewer and trust in credible sources and trust in interesting places. So that's really on you. There's never been a better time to be a reader because there's more choices, but with that comes the really good and the really bad.
Definitely. I think it's really interesting to see some of these sites like a Vice Sports, like now the Cauldron with the Medium, is really trying to bring back that notion of you have a choice to read that more gratuitous stuff on a Bleacher Report or a Deadspin, or you can come here and we're going to give you more literary, long-form, thought-out, thought-provoking pieces. So I guess it's interesting to see, you know, it's more about user options, take opt-in what they want.
Yeah, listen, I support all those places, whether it's Medium or Vice is certainly not a small place, but, you know, I think it's good that there's more. You know, there's once upon a time, where, especially 30, 40 years ago, where there wasn't a lot of entry. There were a lot of barriers to entry. We didn't see a ton of women who were working as reporters or writers. You know, staffs were not integrated. So this is, you know, places like the Cauldron and Vice and other places are really good for sports media because it's inviting, generally speaking, a lot of new people into the market, a lot of younger people into the market. We'll see if they can sort of make money, but I think fundamentally the idea is really good.
It seems like the other side of that poll, I guess, that some people are trying to go all out in creating quality content. Others think that, well, what people want is someone who's going to deliver the hard news now accurately. And you know, there seems to be still a lingering amount of people who value the scoop, the person that breaks the story. And there's a lot of definitely conflicts that come up these days in the social media sphere where the initial source is quickly lost or ignored completely. I mean, what's your overall take on is the value of a scoop still what it once was, or is it pretty much useless now and you know it is giving other people credit almost an afterthought?
Well, there's a lot of questions you have there. The value of a scoop is based on what your employer thinks of that value, what the reader thinks of the scoop itself, and what you as a reader sort of even define as a scoop or news breaking. I mean, for certain stories, the value is incredible. I mean, if you can get a story that nobody else has, that's an important story in the public marketplace, that's really valuable. If we're talking about just basically transactions, like did I just beat you on fifth round pick signing, it's not really that much value. That sort of generally speaking becomes a contest between reporters to see who can break things first. In terms of sourcing, that's a long question. I mean, you know, I think the good people in the business source really well, and I think the bad people in the business don't. I've obviously gotten on ESPN in particular a lot for what I sometimes consider lack sourcing. They've gotten better recently than they were in the past, but still too often it's a little frustrating because they'll use a phrase like media reports instead of putting the specific publication or outlet on their bottom line. I think to me is just very silly.
Is that conscious or is that lazy, you think?
No, it's conscious, of course. Yeah. It's a corporate strategy to try to own the news break. Now they can do that, and that is their choice. I just think they get a little upset when people call them out on it, which I would say is rather hypocritical behavior. You know, the one thing is that's always interesting is no viewer would even care. You'd see on the bottom line, Adrian Wojnarowski of Fox Sports 1 reports X. None of those viewers would be going to Fox Sports 1 because they see that. That's sort of where the fallacy comes in. I would say that actually viewers would say, like, oh, these guys aren't afraid of Fox Sports 1. This is pretty cool that they're putting the place that absolutely brought it. It's very bothersome to reporters because you invest money and time on something, it's your story, and then somebody else at another place is not attributing it at all. Or if they're attributing it, they're putting it under this kind of bogus catch-all category. So there's no doubt it's far more important to people in the business, but I think it's important to people in the business to sort of pay attention to that and to call those out when they swipe or when they don't attribute correctly.
At what point does sourcing become... I don't want to say it's superfluous, but when a story has been out for so long, or even looking at a photograph, for example, if a fan tweets a photograph and it's picked up by Deadspin, then it's picked up by a CBS Sports writer, and then someone else picks up, at what point does it just become too much or not necessary to source the original source of a photo or a...
The answer is what kind of journalist are you? If you want to be a journalist with integrity and accuracy, you report the original source. End of story. I'm not sure how important it is to a reader, but it really just depends on what kind of practitioner you are. If you are a practitioner who wants to sort of, in my opinion, have respect in the business, you find what that original source is and you attribute it. If you don't, then you'll attribute it or to whatever you want, or you'll try to take credit for it on your own. I would say that people in the business notice all the time who's good at this stuff and who's not.
Oh, great point. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what it is whether you have the scoop or not, is someone going to go to you to get the content on that scoop, for example?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that you have that's yours is your reputation and credibility. That's the one thing that, you know, that's the one thing that you own and that you develop and that people will make judgments on. So I would say, you know, nurture that and make that an important thing.
I do want to touch on briefly before we run out of time here. We're talking with Richard Deitch, Sports Illustrated columnist and longtime writer. Is how you definitely are very good at the interactive part of social media. Just to toot your horn a little bit, and I love the way that you've crowdsourced things a lot of times. When you can't watch a broadcast, you'll say, "Hey guys, tune in, and let me know what you see. I want to use your opinions." And I think that's a really neat way. And what's your take on, is that helping you really see what everyone else is seeing? Or do you take that all with a grain of salt, saying, okay, these are the dozens of people on Twitter who will always respond and may have their own jaded look at things that's not necessarily representative of the greater audience out there?
So you're asking me why I respond to people, or I'm not sure I understand the question.
About how you incorporate the sort of crowdsourced opinions that come into you every day, of how much do you take that with a grain of salt when it's coming from people?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. It's just a snapshot. I mean, if I ever use it, I'll say, you know, I asked my Twitter followers X, and here's what they said. But you know, realizing that it's not any kind of, you know, definitive or accurate poll. I mean, ultimately, you're just getting sort of a snapshot of temperament of the people who are following you, and the people who are following you, generally speaking, it's not always, but generally speaking, are like-minded to you. So, you know, these Twitter polls to me and Twitter sentiment are, you know, they're valuable, but you gotta realize that it's still an incredibly tiny slice of anything. And, you know, I mean, even if like Justin Bieber or whoever has the most people, most followers on Twitter did a poll, I would even say that that's, you know, it's not scientifically valid for the most part. It does give you an interesting snapshot. I mean, I do think trending has value, and I do think it has value when it comes to sentiment analysis. I think you have to be careful about sort of proclaiming this to be the absolute truth, because it's just the absolute truth within a subset, if that makes sense.
Does it have enough value then to help a sports center put together its daily rundown, saying, okay, here's what's trending on Twitter or Yahoo Sports Dash, for example?
Yes, I think it has value. I think there is some value in using Twitter for stuff like that, because I think there are a lot of sports fans on Twitter, and I do think there is some kind of sentiment that's fairly accurate when it comes to sports. But again, it's not perfect, because even like a Sports Nation, which obviously has a ton of followers, that's still only a tiny, tiny percentage of sports fans in this country. I mean, minuscule, generally speaking.
Right. And to sports fans who are watching ESPN2 at 4 o'clock on the afternoon.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. That's another thing too, right? I mean, even Sports Nation's audience isn't close to reflective of anything. I mean, you know, it's a tiny, tiny audience even compared to like Sunday Night Football.
Very much so. Well, we are running out of time here. We'll be right back with our Dish with Deitch segment. And speaking of crowdsourcing and interacting on Twitter, we didn't have time to ask Richard about it today, but I highly recommend all the listeners go check out and Google Richard Deitch's single best moment on Twitter. Probably one of the coolest things when it comes to crowdsourcing content you will ever see. We'll be right back with our shareable stat, and then we'll have Richard Deitch back for our Dish with Deitch quick hitting question segment.
Fantastic interview with Richard. He really is articulate, able to get across some really interesting and complex ideas, has a great deal of experience and a breadth of experience that can really lend a lot of knowledge to a lot of these emerging topics in the greater social media and sports atmosphere. But we'll be right back, have a little fun with Richard in our Dish with Deitch segment, some fun quick hitting questions. But first, this episode's shareable stat. And this episode's shareable stat comes via the social media analytics agency called Simply Measured, and they looked at all of their clients across the board and found that tweets with photos, not surprisingly, are the most popular in terms of engagement and garner 110% more engagement than the next highest kind of tweets, which are tweets with links. We'll still have to keep an eye out for how tweets with GIFs end up doing once they get enough data for a sample size there, but it's easy to see that if you're not tweeting enough with photos, you're not doing it right. That's not to say that you should gratuitously throw a photo on every single tweet. It should be relevant, it should have a value add, and it should be eye-catching. The fact is, if you are trying to get more eyes on your tweets, it's a good idea to use photos, and especially now that Twitter is starting to eliminate the pic.twitter extra links, having a photo going along with a link can go a really long way into getting more eyeballs on that tweet and ultimately more clicks on your link and more traffic to your website or to your post or wherever you're trying to get. And engagement also includes replies and favorites as well, so people are actively showing that they are viewing and enjoying your tweet. So if you're not already including pictures with at least, I'd say, around half of your tweets, it's time to start reevaluating that strategy. And if you need, if you're not finding enough pictures out there online, there are plenty of free websites out there where you can find some. And the fact is, if you are missing out on this 110% greater engagement rate on tweets with photos, you're not doing it right. So that's your shareable stat: 110% over twice as much engagement on tweets with photos than the next most popular tweet type of tweet, which are tweets with links. So use it, share it, spread it. And take it with a grain of salt, but take it with a plan too of how you're gonna react to it. Alrighty, that's this episode's shareable stat. We'll be right back having a little fun with our guest Richard Deitch in our Dish with Deitch segment.
Alright, that was episode's shareable stat. Not too surprising, but photos with tweets outperform any other kinds, or tweets with photos outperform any other kind of tweet by over 110%, and the second best kind are tweets with links. So definitely an interesting stat there, but we're not going to talk about tweets with photos with Richard Deitch. We're about to finish up with the Sports Illustrated writer with our Dish with Deitch segment, some fun, quick-hitting questions. So Richard, you survived your interview. Are you now prepared to Dish with Deitch?
I'm prepared. I'm as prepared as any human being can be.
Ah, you better be. All right. The first question, and it's a two-parter. The one sports writer you can never read enough of, and the one sports writer that is most overrated. They can be present or past, or however you'd like to think about it.
All right. That's very hard for me because there honestly is not one. If you were forcing me one, Jesus.
Besides Bill Knack, of course.
Well, it wouldn't be me. I think Bill Knack would be the one that I could never. What was the first part of it? Never do without?
Right, the one you can never read enough of.
Okay, so William Knack would be that one. And the most overrated sports writer? Dear Lord, I don't even know what the overrated is. There's a lot who are not good. I'll get back in that. I'm not ducking it. Let me just think about it. I'll see who I can come up with.
All right,
probably Mike Lupica would probably be the first one that comes to mind.
Okay, he's definitely a guy who likes to hear himself talk a little bit.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, number two. This one is a good one for you. The sports writer that has made the best transition from writing to TV or radio.
Sports writer who has made the best transition from writing to TV or radio. Well, the best sport, I mean, the person who's made the most remarkable transition from writing to becoming a brand is Bill Simmons. It's not really close on that. I mean, Nate Silver obviously done a great job too, but, Bill Simmons has basically built himself a brand away from writing, even though Grantland is obviously writing, but I mean, Simmons sort of oversees it. So that would be there. So there's a writer who, I think Tom Verducci would be the guy who I would say who has had the best transition from being a writer to being on air, even though he writes, because he's basically as good on air as any analyst I've ever seen, even though he's still a writer.
Definitely. It's always interesting to see, you know, some of these guys who've been writers for so long, all of a sudden you see them front in the flesh and you're like, oh, that's what he looks like.
Right. Yeah, Verducci, very handsome guy as well.
Yeah, he's not bad. Number three for you, Richard. The sport with the best bloggers out there, and why?
I think basketball. The NBA has a really – they're so into analytics, and they really care about what they write, and they're really interesting, you know, from the Zach Lowe's of the world to the True Hoop guys. There's a lot of great NBA writing on the web. So I would say that, because not only is there really interesting stuff like narrative and storytelling and about the players, but there's really good analytics stuff. So I think the NBA, I have to say, off the top of my head, the NBA would come to mind first.
Oh, most definitely. And then there's an endless supply of different basketball blogs out there. All right, here we go. So this is a really tough one for you. The best broadcaster, past or present, for the four major sports leagues, NFL, NBA, MLB, NHL. And if you want to throw in a wild card one, you could throw in a fifth one.
Well, you know, it's hard to just sort of do it singularly, because I would normally do it based on the position. Like I would say, you know, who's the best player to play, who's the best analyst, because I think it'd be unfair. But in general, like off the top of my head, I think football, sort of NFL, probably Al Michaels, hockey, NHL, probably Mike Emmerich in my time. Baseball's Vin Scully. It's a pretty easy one. Basketball, you know, I think Marv Albert probably. But, you know, again, or Charles Barkley. But when I would do this, I would do this on position by position. I would never, it's too hard to just name a singular person, because to judge an analyst versus a game caller, it's two different jobs. So I would... So I would separate it, but those would be the ones that come to mind.
Most definitely. Which do you say is more challenging to do? Is it the play-by-play or is it the color analyst?
I think both are challenging in their own right. I think game calling is a little tougher.
I would agree, especially when you get into hockey or Olympics and you get some of those really long names.
Yeah, I agree. The hockey game calling in particular is a pretty tough sport.
All right, number five for you, Richard. I know you've written some columns on women's sports. You've been a beat writer on some women's sports in the recent past. So the women's sport, professional sport out there, with the best opportunity to make it relatively mainstream, and why?
I'd say women's tennis, and it's already mainstream. So that would be the one. The prize money is really good. The players are global and well-known. The sport plays at some, beautiful cathedrals, Wimbledon, French Open, et cetera. So that's, I think, far and away, if you want to exclude the Olympics, that's the most mainstream women's sport, women's tennis.
Definitely a good one. And we'll see what happens, too, when Serena and Venus hang it up for the good and see how
it holds. Big transition. Transition.
Getting to the end here, Richard, a couple quick ones left. Which minority has the most room to grow in sports media? Hispanic, women, Asian, other?
My answer would be all of the above, period. That would be the answer, because they all should and can grow.
Definitely. It would be interesting to see, who becomes the first Hispanic play-by-play person who does a major sport, and maybe NFL or women or whatnot. All right, number seven for you. This would be a fun one. The best sports venue food you've either had yourself or have shared on Twitter.
Well, you mean in the press box or at an event?
At any sporting event.
Well, I have to think sort of internationally. It was pretty fun basically to be in Torino for the 2006 Olympics and being able to leave the press center and head out for a nice Italian dinner in a city that really, really does food. Fantastic. And then we would go a lot of times at night to a place called Al Bicerin, and they serve this drink, which was like hot chocolate and just like a crazy just version of chocolate. And Turin is a very famous city for chocolate. It was like basically drinking liquid of the gods. So I will say Turin, the Olympics in Turin in 2006, probably the best food I had as a sports person.
Oh, I love it. And how about a bonus question for you? Which Buffalo team will win a title first, the Sabres or the Bills?
Jeez. I think if I had to pick now, I'd probably go with the Sabres, because I think their draft and minor league system is in better position than the Bills, although it's easier for a NFL team to turn it around quicker. So I would say the Sabres, though I'm not too sure either team will win anytime in the next couple of years.
Hopefully sometime in the decades.
Hopefully sometime.
All right, Richard, you survived your Dish with Dice segment.
Survived.
Your chance now to give your social media all-star a follow. Tell us someone on Twitter who we should follow, who they are, why they're worth following.
Rather than give one person, I would just say, listen, if you go through the people I follow, you will find great people there. There's not to single out one person as the ultimate Twitter follow is just not a correct answer, because I follow 500 people for 500 different reasons. So I can't honestly sort of single one out, although, as someone who loves to read and loves news, I love following the New York Times and the Washington Post and the BBC and AP, just because I feel like I'm getting all my news delivered to me. But that's a really almost impossible question, because I think there's nobody who is like the perfect Twitter follow, if that makes sense.
Oh, definitely makes sense. It's quite interesting even to go through someone to see who someone is following, get a good snapshot of who is Richard Deitch. He likes food, he likes sports, or whoever.
I would agree with you. I think if you go through someone's follows, you generally get a pretty good sense of who they are.
And lastly,
not a perfect sense, but a pretty good sense.
Definitely. Well, lastly, how about yourself? Where can we find you, your writing, on Twitter, on the web? Give us a quick rundown of where to find Richard.
Anytime you head to SI.com, I'll be there, obviously, in Sports Illustrated the magazine. And Twitter is Richard, R-I-C-H-R-D, Deitch, D-E-I-T-S-C-H.
And we'll link it up in the show notes. And if you're not already following Richard Deitch and you're listening to this podcast, well, you are not doing it right. So go ahead and follow him on Twitter right now. You will not be sorry. But, Richard, thank you so much for your time. We cannot tell you how much appreciate you giving us some of your time and expertise on the podcast today. And hey, best of luck to your Buffalo teams from here on out, and enjoy the rest of the World Cup.
I appreciate it. Yeah, thanks for the good questions.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much again to Richard for being on the podcast. Just a fantastic guest, someone who really has a great deal of knowledge about this space and who really is knee-deep in it every day and learning about it from all different perspectives, from the fan side, from the content publisher side, from the media side, the journalists out there. So just really interesting to see the continued evolution of this space and people like Richard Deitz right there on the sidelines giving us some really informed analysis and play-by-play as we go. But that'll do it for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Tell your friends, spread the word, and get ready for another episode coming up not too far away. Hope you're all enjoying the summer, and we will see you on the next episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Until then, find more information at dsmsports.net and follow me on Twitter at NJH287. See everybody next time.